Tom Slay is the author of 8 books of poetry, including Army Cats and Spacewalk, which won the 2008 Kingsley Tufts Award. He has also published a book of essays, Interview with the Ghost, and a translation of Euripides' Heracles. He received the 2011 John Updike Award, the 2003 Arts and Letters Award, and the 1999 Shelley Memorial Award. Thanks for being with us, Tom.
Thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about long poems. There are quite a few long poems with long lines in Army Cats, and last semester Stanley Plumlee was here, and he had said something about the page having a kind of gravity that wants to pull the poem to a premature ending, and it's the poet's job to learn how to resist that gravity and give the poem space that it needs to develop. So I was wondering if you could just talk a little bit about the process of writing long poems, if that's something you've had to consciously think about, or if it's more natural for you.
It's an interesting thing Stanley said about the gravity.
When I write a poem, I didn't mean any of the sequences in this book to be long poems. One of the things that happened in Army Cats is that because of the kind of material I was dealing with, so much of the book, at least in the first section, is meditating on kind of various aspects of war as I saw it firsthand in Lebanon, spilling over the border into Syria, although not much in those days. So one of the things that's difficult about writing a poem about those subjects is that everything needs qualification, partly because I'm an outsider, for one thing. How do you represent an experience that culturally you're a stranger to, and the conflicts there have been going on for so much longer than, you know, my awareness of them, that the real risk in writing this material is, you know, first of all, what right do you have to say anything about it? That's one thing. So the second thing is, if you do feel like you can say something about it, how do you place yourself so that you acknowledge what the limits are, so that you don't come off as somebody who is this jerk. The whole problem with writing about poetry in subjects that are conventionally thought of as being public is that there's a certain kind of received rhetoric. Everybody knows who the good guys are and who the bad guys are. When you're in the situation, you yourself often feel like you know who the good guys are and who the bad guys are as well. None of that is true. So the thing that's difficult in writing a poem about these kinds of subjects is, first of all, you have to establish what your limits are as an observer. You have to figure out how to put yourself into a poem so it doesn't seem as if you're authority on something that you're not. And then, in order not to sort of have the poem in its unconscious, because poems do have unconsciouses, I think, to have the poem in its unconscious align itself with this side or that side. You know, Seamus Heaney once said a really beautiful thing. He said that, you know, in writing about these subjects, you know, you want to be responsive to all sides at once. So in order to be responsive to all sides at once, you've got to have multiple viewpoints. In order to have multiple viewpoints, you've got to take whoever I am in the poem and make that reflect a lot of different kinds of complexities, which if you're just writing a straightforward dramatic lyric, you wouldn't worry about. So for me, one of the ways to do it is, for example, there's a long poem in this book called The Games. And The Games is a poem in which I have basically two kind of corresponding but opposite characters in it. Both of those people were based on people I knew, and one of them died. And I sort of took those two characters and I put them in this kind of interesting conversation. And the conversation just had to do with one who was kind of an adroit, super adroit public figure, a diplomatic physician. And the other was kind of, you know, I loved him deeply. He was a kind of roaring boy. He was in part modeled on my friend Liam Rector, who was definitely a roaring boy and a wonderfully actively political person. And then it also had to do with an incident of somebody who'd been assassinated because of his political involvements in Lebanon. And of course, assassination is the most common thing in the world in Lebanon. I mean, you're watching television and they'll have a commercial come on in which a guy in a very attractive leather coat with a very expensive car is walking down the street. In America, you would think, well, it's either a fashion ad or a car ad. But in Lebanon, it's a bomb detector ad. So you're watching the guy walk to his car, and then there's the guy has a little thing that looks like a, you know, key opener, and he turns it on and shines it, and that detects if there's plastique underneath the car to blow it up. Yeah, Lebanon is just full of those kinds of hilarious contradictions. The fact that, you know, assassination would have entered into the world so that you could have commercial competition about which brand, you know, well, I like the color of my detector. How about your detector? That's the kind of loony, you know, sort of underside, which I actually, that kind of surreal humor, I actually deeply respond to. And many of my poems are infused with that kind of surreal humor. So, for example, in the games, I've got these two characters sort of playing off each other. And then I suddenly have this moment in which I have a voice comes out of the blue, which seems to be someone who is living during the time of, say, Augustus Caesar, the heyday of the games in the Colosseum. And the guy is talking about these sorts of very intricate political alliances that we feel. And so he talks about how in the morning, the most low rent of the people who get killed in the gladiatorial games were always the Christians. I mean, they didn't even bother to like put them in the arena with humans. They just threw them in there with the animals and let the animals have their fun. The people who were much more high rent were the criminals who they would crucify during the noontime break. And then at the end of the day, of course, there would be thousands and thousands of animals slain in some of these games. And then, this is a fact I never knew, then they would cut up the animals and distribute them. So people could get like bear steaks and lion steaks and all kinds of stuff. And so I just thought, wow, wouldn't it be interesting, you know, to put yourself in the role of one of these provincials from outside Rome who comes into Rome. And before the provincial was a Roman, he was, of course, a barbarian waiting to be conquered by Rome. But now that he's been incorporated into the empire, he has all the privileges of the empire, that is, bread and circus, bear steaks, lion steaks. I thought, wow, wouldn't that be fun to be him? And what would he say about his historical circumstances? Now, you know, that's not what, in my experience, when people claim to be witnesses, that's not what they're doing. You know, I'm not interested in being the just man standing on the mountain shaking my finger at people. I don't think anybody who writes poems, at least consciously, is trying to do that. But I have no interest in being a spokesman. And I have no interest in simplifying my experience, and I don't have any interest in pretending to know things that I don't know. I think one of the real problems with writing poems of this kind is that very often the poet, the figure of the poet in the poem, looms very large in the landscape. And the political situation kind of vanishes, such you've got this heroic figure in front of history without casting a very, very big shadow. And I don't really think that's a viable way of talking about these subjects any longer. I don't think that you're going to have the lone witness speaking truth to power. For one thing, power doesn't give a shit if you speak truth to it. And truth is so often reduced in those circumstances. One of the things that people don't really think about much, or at least in my experience they don't, is when you read a play like King Lear, say, and you have Kent, and then you've got the two sisters. And lots of people have said this before, it's not original. But one thing that I think immediately becomes clear, if you begin to have this kind of viewpoint, is that the only difference between Lear and his daughters, or between Kent and Oswald, who serves Lear's daughters, is that Kent's side has their alibis in order, and Oswald and company don't have their alibis in order. And so I'm interested in not having a poem in which I'm just reflecting one set of alibis or another. And I think the only way to do that is to have multiple viewpoints. And I think the other way to do it is a kind of self-irony, kind of self-mockery, a sort of undercutting of your authority as opposed to an insistence on it. So humor, albeit a dark humor, and I realize when, you know, I talk about my interest in the consumer aspects of bomb detectors, lots of people aren't going to find that funny. But I find that very funny, and it's partly because of a certain kind of piousness that surrounds talking about these things. And I'm very impatient with that kind of thing. There's a very good war reporter, writes for the New Yorker often, and the thing I often find about his writing is there's a certain kind of convention that he's bought into. And the convention is he's very tight-lipped. There's a certain kind of unspoken self-importance. There's a certain just the facts, ma'am, kind of approach. We were talking about this in Amelia's class the other day. And really, you know, who am I on the scene? I'm some fucking guy dropped down in the middle of a situation which just scares the piss out of me, which I have absolutely no equipment to deal with culturally or emotionally. I'm high as a kite on the weirdness of it all, the violence of it all, the intensity of it all. I'm ashamed for being high as a kite on the weirdness of it all, the violence of it all. And at the same time, there's a sort of utter absurdity that I feel at the same moment. Like, what doesn't fit in this picture? What doesn't fit in this picture is you don't fit in this picture. Now, that's not the heroic stance of Anna Akhmatova standing in line. I've written about this. You know, in front of the Lubyanka prison, and the woman comes up to her and says, you know, can you record this? She says, I can. Now, if somebody came up to me and said, can I record this? I would say, I don't know. I don't have a tape recorder. I mean, I don't speak the language. So one of the things I think that I can do in writing a long poem is that when I sat down and tried to write these poems, as soon as I finish one section, it feels partial. It feels insufficient. So in order to get those multiple viewpoints, I can have this poem addresses this part of the subject. Then there's a kind of counter argument that goes on in my mind saying, oh, you're really a pretentious ass in that part of the poem. Why don't you be less of a pretentious ass in this part of the poem and be kind of a smart ass about the pretentious ass? You know, it's that kind of way of undercutting a certain kind of authority in order to have a much more comprehensive understanding of what the experience really is. Because the experience isn't, for people living through it, it's immensely complex and it's immensely ordinary. And that's one kind of long poem. So there are a lot of sequences in this book, because the sequences in a way are, at least as far as I'm concerned, are one way to address many different elements of an experience without having this kind of monumental, this is the frame. I want to break the frame as much as I possibly can. And, you know, it's not the kind of thing which, you know, I mean, I was to be asked to do the inaugural poem, and I could read that poem about the guy there at the games wondering if he's got the bear steaks and the lion steaks. He particularly likes the lion steaks. That would be my idea of an inaugural poem. long answer, but there are different kinds of long poems, you know. I mean, I wrote a really long poem because I've written about it. I won't be coy. I have a blood disease. I've had one for years. And, you know, it's given me some serious trouble over the years of the mortality kind. But that was a very different kind of poem to write, you know. An arc of an experience, you know, kind of a narrative shape to it, although the narrative wasn't based on events. The narrative was more based on a kind of, you know, an emotional progression. And so that those are the kinds of things, you know, obviously poems dictate their own shapes.
You may have started answering this in your previous question, but how did your work as a journalist kind of impact your work as a poet at all, especially like in terms of process and form?
Right. Well, okay. You know, full disclosure, I'm not a real journalist. I'm an amateur. And I want to, a part of me is very committed to remaining that. So I don't want to write against deadlines. I don't want to do the standard kind of op-ed thing. I don't want to have opinions. I don't want to be viewy. For one thing, I don't know enough to be viewy. For another thing, I just think that language is utterly dead and is useless and accomplishes nothing. It doesn't move the conversation any further at one iota. You know, Robert Frost said it was a really beautiful thing to say. He said something like, poetry is the extravagance of grief, and politics is the extravagance of grievance. It's an interesting thing when Frost says that. Like all those statements, particularly when you attach a famous name to it, like, ooh, a voice from the Oracle. So I had this in mind when I was in Lebanon. There was a certain point in which I was up at the up in the Golan Heights. It took us up there. Now, you know, you hear the phrase Golan Heights, and you think, yeah, you know, like Golan Heights can't be that big. It's a height, so you get there. And the Golan Heights are some of the most prime real estate in the Middle East. Some of the best farmland. And then it becomes totally clear why everybody wants them. So there's a little town there called Kenitra. And during the most recent Israeli-Lebanese war, but the previous one, when the war ended, Israel, of course, took the Golan Heights from Syria. And what the Israeli army did is they stripped the town. When I say stripped the town, they stripped it right down the doorknobs. And they put all that hardware on trucks and they shipped it back to Israel. So when you go visit the town now, of course it's on Syrian territory, it's a Syrian propaganda site. And of course they have their version of the tale, and then Israelis have their version of the tale. And everybody's version is like, you know, the budget meetings. There's no place for reality to intercede, you know, because everybody has the realities and they're utterly separate. So in terms of this grief and grievance, when we were there, there was a big sign that said something like, we must have peace, the peace that restores the Golan Heights to Syria. We must have peace, the peace that restores the Golan Heights to Syria, which is kind of like Orwellian doublespeak for, if we ever get enough bombs, we will bomb them back to the Stone Age and get the Golan Heights back. That's what it really means. So, on the one hand, you know, you're thinking, that's grievance. That's the kind of language of grievance. So, okay, you think, sure, that's an obvious thing. So later the same day, we go to a village. We happen to run into a guy who's Palestinian, because we're in a Palestinian town. And he brings us back to his house, and he tells us the story about his life. And basically, I won't go into the whole story, but at one point in the story, during the war between the initial war and the Nakba in 1948, what's called the expulsion of Palestinians from their territories, or what's putatively their territories. I can just see poor Blackbird getting shut down over this interview. So I'm going to be very careful in how I phrase things here. Not simply because I'm trying to be coy or trying to be politic, but also because it's deeply complicated and I'm not the authority. So he told a story in which, because he was being expelled from his village, that one of the things that he saw was his mother shot dead in front of him. Extremely reasonable man. And then he's talking about how the deeds were stained with blood. Now, I heard that, deeds stained with blood. I thought, this is how it was translated into English and Arabic. I thought, my goodness, that's like positively Shakespearean, deeds stained with blood. So I'm thinking like, wow, that's the extravagance of grief, a kind of poetry about it. But the thing that I didn't realize was he meant it literally, that the deed of the house was stained with blood. And then he said to me, would you like to see the deeds? And then you're like, I'm thinking like, I didn't have Super 8 cameras in those days. I mean, literally, I think, how is he going to show me the deeds? And I said, sure. And he said, just a second. And he takes his cell phone out and he calls his nephew. He says, can you bring the deed over with key? Now, I didn't know in those days that many of the Palestinians have the keys to their old homes still on them. And that's passed down to, you know, a couple of generations now. So, you know, nephew drives up on the, you know, little motorcycle and comes in. And he said, here's the deed. We do look at it, and there's a big brown stain on it. Now, that's the extravagance of grief, and that's the extravagance of grievance. And unless people decide that both of those things are allowable in conversation at the same time, I can't see any hope at all. And the thing about it is that this old man was very eloquent, very reasonable person. And then at a certain point, you know, to be fair in the conversation, it was clear to me that the conversation took a certain turn in which it began to talk about the European Jews who would come in as opposed to the Arabic Jews, who were, in his words, their brothers, the Arabic Jews were. He very much wanted the European Jews to go back to. Now, there was a lot of hate in the room at that moment. And the thing about it is that people want to oversimplify it. They just want him to be full of hate. They don't want to think, this is a man who, when he was a child, saw his mother shot dead, and he's lived the life of an exile. So, you know, you witness these kinds of things, and, you know, they're so complicated. They just go way beyond. And the only way to represent them is to find some kind of language which is oblique, you know, which has all the kind of odd resonances of the experience about it. It's almost a certain kind, I'm not much interested in a conscious sort of surrealism. But there's qualities to the experience that are so absurd. Biggest absurdity being me listening to this. And so I want to incorporate all that into the, you know, into the texture of it. The worst thing, I think, about writing of a certain kind about these subjects, and then I'll get back to your journalism, is the sort of ponderous, serious, moral earnestness
just so fucking boring. I hate that kind of writing. I can just see the self-importance of the writer ballooning in front of the material until suddenly the only thing I can see is the heroic ego of the writer. I want everything undercut. I want many, many different planes of irony cutting through an experience. Because that seems to me the only truthful way that I can register. You know, as an outsider, I'm an outsider. You know, inside my own world, I can make different kinds of approaches to a subject. But just in terms of what the journalism has done for me, well, you can see it's changed me as a person. It's meant a lot to me as a man. I've seen things, but I know I sound like the ending of, it's one of my favorite movies, Blade Runner. Remember at the very end when Rutger Hauer's there, and you think he's gonna kill Decker, and he's there and he's got the nail and he's just grabbed, and he begins on this rhapsody. He said, "I've seen things in the galaxies."
It's one of my favorite moments in all the movies. It's super fucking hokey. But it's really great. It's just a beautiful, great moment of ludicrous overacting. Utterly convincing on some deep level for me. So, you know, I've seen things. You know, but, you know, if you lowercase it, yeah, I've seen some things that really changed me. I've had some conversations and experiences that have really changed me. And I can't write the same anymore. I mean, it doesn't mean that I know what that means in terms of sitting down and writing a poem, because I don't. You know? But, you know, it doesn't have to be that kind of, in a public sense, a big experience that does that. Lots of things do that to you. But I have, you know, I've had a serious illness for many years. That changes. I've had these experiences in the last 6 or 7 years. Those things change. And I think that on a really deep level, that gets into your work. You know, I was in Mogadishu doing a piece on Somali refugees. That's a long piece. It took me about 3 years to do that. And that's the problem with doing the kind of journalism I do. It's long form. It takes a long time to do it. Because it's all about texture. I don't have opinions, except to undercut them, because my opinions don't matter. But you know, it's not like I'm looking for it, but always in these situations, moments of great humor and hilarity arise. And you don't ever see that in The New Yorker. It's because I'm here in Mogadishu, the bombs are falling, it's all terrible. As opposed to a friend of mine who took the photographs of the article we did. His idea is, I'm here in Mogadishu shaving. And as I'm shaving, there are bombs falling, and I cut myself. Damn! You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing. You know, I was talking a little bit about this with Amelia last night, you know, getting into, flying into Air Mogadishu. Have a nice day or wherever your travels take you in Mogadishu. you know, your visa form has all the standard things in the very bottom. It says, what weapons will you be importing? RPG? You can check all the different weapons out and be importing in Mogadishu. So, you get off the plane, you know, you're looking at your armored vehicle you're going to be riding around in with, you know, 50 caliber machine guns, 20 caliber machine guns mounted up there. And yeah, this is really weird. I mean, geez, and the guy who's running the thing is wonderful Irish aid public affairs guy. Fabulously funny, you know, sense of humor. I'm such a doofus. You know, there's like my pile of flak jackets, pile of helmets, you know, another pile of flak jackets. One's baby blue, the other is light blue. And so I just say to Andy, "So, Andy, we got two colors, huh?" And he says, Tom,
yeah, you've got all the colors you need. And then I say, well, which one do you think I should choose, Andy? And Andy just says, oh, Tom, just choose the color that goes the best with your eyes.
So I'm such an idiot. I don't know that light blue is UN affiliated, and dark blue means unaffiliated. So I choose light blue because I like the baby blue.
But see, if you're captured, being UN affiliated can be good, or it can be really bad. These are the kinds of decisions that you're making in a moment of hilarity, which could actually affect, you know, your life, you know.
So, you know, driving around in Mogadishu in a Caspier, a CASSPIR, which were these old armored vehicles that they used to use in South Africa to terrorize the townships. And now the African Union soldiers own them, and they're doing a kind of trying to do a police action in the streets of Mogadishu. And, you know, you're driving around in the Caspier, you know, the guy with the 50 caliber standing, a very nice guy from Burundi, you know, and named Patrice, and you're talking a little bit in French. And it's like you're driving around, and I'm looking right into the guy's butt the whole time. You know, I mean, skinny little guy, you know, with his helmet on. And the quality of the surreal as you go by, you know, a market and this, you know, horrendous smell hits you in the face. It's the smell of camel meat. And these are things that you would never, ever experience at home. you know, and you're just, you're sitting there listening to I can't name names here, but anyway, you're sitting listening to one of the guys tell about how they had a journalist come in for one of the big networks, and the only thing the guy could think about was how he looked. So he was constantly saying, how's my collar look? Did my helmet mess up my hair?
You know, who else in the catcher's thinking like, helmet mess up his hair,
you know, and they're all there, of course, because it's like big story, famine in East Africa, starving bodies of black people, you know, or you know, Arabics, lots of skinny looking ribs, you know, there's a certain kind of like, you know, vulturous obscenity about it, and all that fucking guy can think about is how his goddamn hair looks. So at a certain moment, you know, he's like combed his hair for the 18,000th time. Everybody's sitting in the Caspier, and the security officer is thinking, you know, I mean, we got a schedule to keep, and there's a reason why you keep a schedule in a place like Mogadishu, at least a year ago. And finally, he just turns to the guy. He said, the guy's like straightening his collar out. He said, did my flak jacket, how's my collar? I said, okay, I'm up on the flak jacket. The guy said, yeah, it's fine. It's fine. Okay. And finally, the security guard just turns to the guy, to the network dude, and he just says, okay, Ken Doll, are you ready to go? And the guy says, what? What do you mean, Ken Doll? And he says, you know what I mean, Ken and Barbie, are you ready to go? Well, that's the kind of thing you want in your reporting, right? That's the thing I want to read about. You know what I mean? Or, you know, being among the kids, you know, they have such spirit, you know. You know, and they like your cracking jokes right and left. I remember once I was talking to a bunch of goat and camel sellers, meeting this guy in the market, and said, so, you know, I had a translator naturally, and all these guys are gathering around me, and we're doing the whole thing. And a lot of men, Somali men, when they get to a certain age, they put henna in their beard to cover up the gray. And so I said to the guy, you know, so how come you're putting a henna in your, because I wasn't aware of that. He said, oh, well, for beauty. And I said, oh, well, you're very beautiful. Big laugh.
So I said, so how many children do you have? So I said, 8 children and 4 wives. And he looks at me and he says, and how many children and wives do you have? And I'm thinking, oh man, I'm really going to be in a disadvantage here. So I'm thinking, going through my Henny Youngman joke repertoire, you know, the old Borscht Belt comic, and I'm thinking, oh, I think I know how to answer this one. Only one wife, and that's more than enough. And the thing is very reliable. Henny Youngman jokes are universal. It brought down the house. Big laugh in the middle of his refugee camp.
Got the logo. The guy's got one wife.
You know, so suddenly these people are cartoons. You know, they're not just these like sad, pathetic figures. And that's the thing that is just I can't stand about the way these folks are represented. And the reason why is because nobody takes the fucking time to talk to them. Or if they take the time to talk to them, and many do, you know, it's just the one dimensionality of what they feel is proper to be represented. You know, the fact that, you know, any Youngman joke is universal, I think that's a pretty rare discovery. Take my wife, please. I'm thinking to myself, one for Slay. You know, you really are a foreign correspondent. So, you know, I mean, it's a long, long answer, but my journalism meant a lot to me as a person. And I certainly have met some just wonderful, wonderful people in circumstances that I never would have ever seen at any other time.
Probably have time for one more question, maybe two short ones.
I'll ask one. So throughout your books, you have many different sorts of translations or poems that are after other writers like Dante and Waking and Ovid. And then you did the translation of Euripides as well. Can you talk a little bit about how translation is a part of your process in writing a book project or doing a book project, or if you see translation as a sort of kind of ekphrastic move?
Oh, that's interesting. I think probably you have a more interesting answer than I would about the ekphrastic guy. I hadn't thought about it. It's quite interesting. You know, one thing about translation is, I'll just tell a brief story about it. Years ago, before the first Gulf War, I was in Paris, and I went to the antiquities section. And I've written about this in an essay. But anyway, I found a little cuneiform tablet, which had this thing about the destruction of the city of Ur. And of course, the city of Ur is was on an Iraqi air base. It still is there. I mean, there's a big ziggurat, and the rest of it is an Iraqi air base. And so I thought it was in French. So it was Akkadian, which is an ancient Babylonian language, more ancient than Babylonian. Anyway, it was an Akkadian, and so I copied the French down and had the postcard with the, you know, it looks Akkadian to me. So, very fluent in ancient Akkadian. So I had the French. And I took it home, and it sat there on my desk. I copied it down, you know, on the back of a piece of paper or something, because they had it translated there. And I just took it home, and it sat there. And so it's one of those things you think, oh, I'll translate this at a certain point. And then I was reading David Ferry, great translator, his translations of the Odes of Horace. This shows you how long ago it was, a while ago. And I saw the shapes that David was making. I was comparing the shapes and the stanza shapes compared to the, at least the way they were printed in the Fos-on-Fos in the Ferry translation. So you have the Ferry here, and you got your Horace here. And it suddenly dawned on me that from a French translation,
I could take a kind of Horatian stanza shape mediated to the English of David Ferry and maybe do this in English. A lot of different steps, right? And one of the reasons, so I did it. And it seemed to me like a kind of generalized statement about the ineluctable decay and destruction of civilizations and then their rebuilding, because that's really what it is. I mean, it sounds very lofty in those terms, but you know, that's kind of what it is. And then the first Gulf War came along. And then everybody was, hey, you got that little fragment? Can we even publish this in our anti-war book? And then suddenly everybody said, think, oh my God, he's translated this in response to the pressures of the moment. It's not at all what happened. I mean, I translated it, and then time caught up, and that was political. Whereas before it had been general and philosophical. So that taught me a lot. So when I wrote a longer poem, very oblique poem about 9/11, partly because, you know, it's the site, yeah, having been in close proximity to the site and all the rest of that, I came across in the, there's an Egyptian book of ancient spells, and there's this crazy rant by this guy who wants all power. He says, you know, and he's doing this invocation to get power. I'm reading along, and it's a little, it's very disturbing. And then suddenly, I get to this little paragraph, and he said, I am Thoth, I am this, I am that, I am going to get all power if the gods will help me, and if the gods don't help me, then I will bring down the twin mountains. And I said, gotta use it. No. And there it is. And then at the very end, it's an invocation about how if he's given this power, that he will speak the truth to everyone. And he has a long list of all his contemporaries. Like, you know, back at the really the beginning of writing, the Syrians, the this, the that, he will speak truth to all of those people. And of course, he's a crazy lunatic ranting at the top of his voice, but then he's going to speak truth at the end. I thought, I'll just put this as part of the sequence. That's going to be a different kind of texture. It's outside of my time. You know, you put that in there, nobody's going to be able to pin you down. 9/11, terrible tragedy. Yeah, but what does that mean exactly? So, and when I work in translation, I'm often aware of the kind of historical double vision. You're looking through the lens at a contemporary event, through something that happened 2,000 years ago. And, you know, one thing about Pound's Cathay poems, the Chinese translations that he did, he wrote those as a, he put those poems in a book, positioned them in such a way that they were a direct commentary on the First World War. So, I think translation can be, it can have those kinds of subtle gestures of, you know, politics is too crude of a word, but like a political emotion. And they can nail that down in ways that me speaking in my own voice couldn't do, because it's got that kind of historical resonance in which the echoes are so complicated. Nobody can pin you down to a certain easy, resolvable position, which is why I love poetry. So, I thought that was a pretty good way to end it, didn't you? All right, sorry.
Thank you so much, Tom, for taking the time to answer our questions.
Yeah. Oh, you're right.